Our next case is number 21-2104, SRM Group, Inc. v. Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Okay, Mr. Walters.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. We've likely all heard the concept of the empty chair defense. This arises when a defendant blames a person absent at trial, and that absent defendant is unable to defend himself. Well, this appeal is about an empty chair opinion witness. Why do we say that? According to the United States Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, or the Board, the appellant's claim, in this case, seeking additional compensation arising from two unilateral contract modifications issued by the government, fails because appellant did not explain the opinions of a witness that did not testify at the evidentiary hearing.
You put the witness's testimony in the record. I mean, you know, it was there, and you never said we're not relying on it. You may, in your post-hearing brief, not have relied on it, but you never said we're disclaiming the testimony or withdrawing it. You put it in, and there it was. It was part of the record.
Yes, Your Honor. It was in the record. It was in the record because it contained a significant amount of cost information and supporting data upon which all of the experts relied, including...
You were worried that if it didn't remain in the record that the board might say, well, you know, it's too late to put this stuff in. But having put it into the record, why is it beyond the board's authority to say, well, you put in this evidence, you have to reconcile it, you have to explain it?
Well, we contend that that's requiring the appellant to satisfy an impossible burden, because the testimony that was presented at hearing was the opinion of the expert who presided at the hearing, who testified at the hearing, and it was his opinions that he was relying on. What the board did here is the board found that we did not satisfy our burden of proof because we did not explain or reconcile the opinions of a non-testifying expert. That witness was not available to make statements or give testimony or subject to cross-examination. Yes, his reports were in the record, but there was no indication that SRM ever intended to rely upon that, just the data that was in those reports.
So one analogy that comes to my mind is this, and tell me why this is a bad analogy. So a scientist running a lab and, you know, runs an experiment five times and writes up the results from number five. Wouldn't it be a legitimate thing for other scientists, for readers to say, I don't really think I can credit what you are saying, because you haven't addressed seemingly contrary results in the first four experiments. Why isn't that a kind of a legitimate fact assessment technique?
Respectfully,
and why is this different from that?
Respectfully, I think this is different from that because as I understand Your Honor's question or your hypothetical, you're asking the witness who is testifying as to his prior iterations to explain why he changed his or modified his experiment.
Seemingly contrary evidence in the seemingly contrary evidence.
But that's not the situation we have here. We have a subsequent.
Suppose you had two experts here, both of whom testified. Suppose Raddick and
Fordham
had both testified and gave these inconsistent things. Could the board then tax you for not explaining and reconciling the two pieces of testimony?
I think the board could, because the experts in both of those cases would have had the opportunity to explain their opinions, state their positions, be subject to cross-examination, but we don't have that here.
The problem here is that we're talking about your evidence.
I'm sorry?
We're talking about your evidence, talking about your expert. And you had one expert, and that expert ultimately was you got another one to rely on, but you didn't move to strike the part of the first expert's evidence that you didn't like or you found unfavorable. Maybe you didn't think about it, but as fair as it may seem, you're saddled with it because you took on that burden and never did anything about it.
I agree, Your Honor, that we didn't run away from that prior expert's findings or conclusions, and this really isn't about that. This is an issue of whether the board required and the board imposed upon appellant a higher burden of proof because, effectively, we had to eliminate all uncertainties created by prior opinions or prior expert reports.
All I had to do was withdraw it, which you didn't do.
We did not do that because we relied upon, we needed the cost information, the supporting documentation that was in the record, in those reports, was
you could have withdrawn everything but that cost information.
Respectfully, I believe that there would have been objections to that because the government's attorneys relied upon that information as well. But the issue here, again, is whether expert who testified...
I'm asking withdrawing everything except the data.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Withdrawing everything except the data. You could have done that.
We could have, but we weren't... We didn't. There wasn't anything in there that we objected to, necessarily.
Now you see the problem. You have two experts, and they both are offering competing or contradictory, or let's just say inconsistent.
They're offering different methodologies. All of the expert opinions found that SRM was entitled to additional compensation, and we've cited this in our briefs. Additional compensation was permissible under their analyses. Even Mr. Raddick's different iterations of his report found that SRM was entitled to different methodologies. Mr. Fordham's opinion wasn't the highest or it wasn't the lowest. It was somewhere in between. So we're not running away from or attempting to avoid the evidence in the record as to the prior opinions. What our argument is that the board held us to a higher standard of proof by requiring our expert and by rejecting our claim for quantum by virtue of the fact that our expert who testified at hearing did not explain why his methodology differed from those of the prior testimony. And we contend that's legal error. That's holding SRM to a higher burden of proof. This really, with all respect, is not an evidentiary issue. It's a legal issue as to what the appellant's burden of proof is at trial. The other issue that I think warrants mentioning to the court is an issue that we raised in our motion for reconsideration, and that we've briefed this issue, and that has to do with the clear abuse of discretion that the board committed on the appellant's motion for reconsideration. We did not raise the issue of credibility of the witnesses. We did not think that was appropriate on a motion for reconsideration. Yet the board injected itself into that situation and found that our real complaint was that we did not find its expert witness analysis credible. And at the hearing and in the original order, there was no issue of Mr. Fordham's credibility. But then on reconsideration, the board changed its mind and sua sponte chose to weigh in on Fordham's credibility in a very negative way. The judge who issued the after-the-fact credibility determination was not even the judge who presided over the evidentiary hearing. In the interim, between issuance of the final order and the motion, the judge who presided over the hearing had resigned or retired from the board. So we had a new judge who was weighing in sua sponte on credibility of the witness. And we contend that's an abuse of discretion. Finally, I would just ask that the issue we're seeking here, we're not asking this court to retry the issue of damages. And I believe the government has argued that in its briefing. We don't believe that the court need reach the issue of damages or any factual issues. If the court finds that the board imposed upon the appellant a correct burden of proof, we don't get to the numbers. However, if the court finds that the board erred in the burden of proof imposed upon the appellant, then we believe that on remand the board has adequate evidence to determine quantum based on the evidence presented at the hearing and in the record. All of the evidence, including Mr. Raddick's opinion.
Well, the board didn't like your evidence. It said it was estimates rather than actual cost. And we said recently in the Kellogg case that you can't do that.
I disagree respectfully with the board's findings there. Earlier claim quantifications were based on estimates because of the fact that the work was ongoing. When the government added back the service of the two dormitory buildings, the estimated costs in the negotiations between the government and the appellant were based on estimated costs. But the costs presented by to a certain extent, by Mr. Raddick and by Mr. Ford were based on actual cost estimates. They weren't segregated costs. They were looking at actual costs incurred and then allocated according to certain methodologies that these experts believed were appropriate and acceptable methodologies.
And which weren't rooted in actual experience.
I'm sorry.
And which weren't rooted in actual experience.
They were rooted based on those experts' expertise in quantifying claims of this type.
Okay, you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Oliver?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. SRB's central argument that the Board improperly considered the expert reports of its non-testifying expert is directly and unmistakably refuted by Rule 9 of the Civilian Board of Contract Appeals, which defines what is the record for decision. Part of what the record for decision, that is what the Board may consider, includes the Rule 4 appeal file that the parties submit to the Board.
Under your rules, could SRM had withdrawn part of the evidence from the first expert?
Yeah, it could have withdrawn. It could have moved to a strike. In fact, the Board, during the hearing, as is indicated in the reconsideration decision, expressly reminded SRM that these prior expert reports, the reports of Mr. Raddick, are still in the record. Yet, despite that notification, that reminder, SRM, for its own reasons, its own tactical reasons, of which I'm not aware, decided not to object and say, well, we want to strike the analysis of Mr. Raddick because it differs and we think it's not reliable. All the arguments that SRM made in its reply brief, how unreliable Mr. Raddick's analysis is, how he's not even an expert, all of that they could have made at that time when the Board said, these reports are still in the record, meaning under Rule 9 of my rules, that is part of the record of decision. I'm allowed to decide that in determining whether or not you have met your burden of proof. But SRM blinked at that moment and decided not to move to strike. It did not object. And therefore, when it was time for the Board to decide whether or not SRM had met its burden of proof, whether or not by a preponderance of the evidence it had shown that the cost that it claimed, the $3.3 million costs, were causally related to the change in the contract, it could not meet that burden for several reasons, one of which certainly is the fact that you have analyses by Mr. Raddick, methodologies that are inconsistent with Mr. Fordham's, their testifying expert, and there was no expert, there's no witness that could explain for the Board how do you reconcile these two things. That was one of the grounds that the Board found that you needed to have done, because it's, again, part of the record of decision. And the second was independent of that, which is that even if you look at Mr. Fordham's analysis, his methodology, it's not persuasive compared to the government's testifying expert, Mr. Hudak, because that's Mr. Hudak persuasively found, and that's the word that the Board found, persuasively found, the more sensible and reasonable methodology is to look at the specific individual cost elements that are tied to the change in the contract requirements. That's what the government did, and that's how it determined ultimately that there was approximately $800,000 worth of of difference between the caused by the contract requirements, which pales in comparison to the $2.1 million that the government paid SRM for those changes pursuant to modifications 16 and 43, which is why ultimately the government is owed money, although we're not seeking it because we waived that right. But the point is that second round is simply looking at what Mr. Fordham did and saying, you haven't met your burden of proof just by looking at your analysis. What you're doing is taking this 22% of all the costs and attributing it to the claim, but not looking at whether or not that 22% of extra cleanings that you're claiming is actually related to a change in the contract requirements, which is what under the law you have to do. You're entitled to the change, not to an overall total cost figure.
The Board's initial determination stated that although Mr. Fordham, and I think Mr. Fordham was a second expert, right? Although Mr. Fordham adequately explained his own methodology, he did not account for the different methodologies, the different conclusions, nor could he justify the varying amounts claimed. I find it that it would be unfair to have one expert explain the methodologies of another expert and especially to try to shore them up or to make them credible. Is that what happened here?
That's not what's happened here. This is not a bolstering argument.
But this is a language out of the board's decision.
I agree. You correctly quoted from what the board said, but in the context of what of that statement by the board is, yes, Mr. Fordham, I understand. I adequately explained, meaning I understand what your methodology is. I don't have any questions as to what you did. But the board went on to say that Mr. Hudak's critiques of that methodology, which Mr. Fordham adequately explained, that Mr. Hudak's analysis was more persuasive for the reasons I just mentioned. Okay, and so what the board was not expecting, certainly Mr. Fordham to bolster his opinion on the back of Mr. Raddick. That's not the issue, because I agree under Federal Rule of Evidence 703, you can't bolster and say,
That would be an error, wouldn't it?
Well, in the context of, not necessarily, in the context of the board proceeding under Rule 10, the board is not bound by the Federal Rules of Evidence. And it's a guide, and hearsay is generally admitted unless there's some objection, in which there was none here. So that's a separate argument. Our point is, Federal Rules of Evidence don't apply, one. So that there are arguments about whether or not it violated Federal Rules of Evidence or not applicable. But even if it is, even if you do apply Federal Rules of Evidence, that the concern with 703 is if you're an expert and you're saying, I'm going to rely upon a second expert to make my expert opinion better. You're basically almost co-opting or piggybacking off of that expert, even though it's not your own work. And that's a 703 problem. Here, that's not what the board was expecting. The board was saying the exact opposite, which is, just as Mr. Hudak, who testified, who's the government expert, just as his analysis is different than yours, and that's a problem, your own expert, who's not testifying, whose reports you left in the record, therefore I have to consider it as part of the record of decision, you also have no witness to explain why that methodology, which, again, it was your expert, how is your analysis better, more persuasive than your own prior expert? It's no different than explaining why Mr. Hudak's analysis or his critiques are not merited or not worthy compared to your own. It's the same thing. The problem here is one of SRM's own making, which is if they wanted to avoid having the board expect some sort of witness to explain the difference between its prior expert and its testifying expert, all it had to do was object and move to strike Mr. Raddick's expert report, specifically the analysis. If they wanted to keep the costs, the data, underlying data, that's fine. That was not an issue. What the board was saying was the reports themselves, the analyses, they're still in the record. What do you want to do? They kept it in. But now they're stuck with the consequences of that decision.
Do you regard the board's ruling in this respect as being a necessary part of the decision?
Can you repeat that, Your Honor?
Do you think that the board's ruling in this respect about the obligation to reconcile is a necessary part of the decision?
No, I don't. It's not a necessary part of the decision because there are really two prongs of the board's decision. If you read the board's decision carefully on Appendix 9 at the very end, it makes a conclusion. Yes, the very first sentence of its holding says, on balance, we find that Mr. Hudak's analysis, his critiques of Mr. Fordham's report analysis, we find them persuasive. And earlier in the opinion, the board said, and this is the only time that the board used the word credible, found Mr. Hudak to be a credible witness. Okay, but anyway, so the first prong was, the critiques that Mr. Hudak make are more persuasive. And that in and of itself is enough for SRM not to meet the burden of proof because Mr. Hudak's critiques, as the board outlined in its opinion, show that the most credible and most reasonable way to address the issue of damages to look at individual cost elements, link it to the contract requirements that changed, and see what that delta is, what that amount is, not what Mr. Fordham did, which was take a total cost approach, take a flat 22% claim, a figure, and not look at the difference in requirements. So that's in and of itself, you haven't met your burden of proof. Your testifying expert is less persuasive than the government's testifying expert. End of story. The second sentence is, again, the basis of their appeal, which is also your expert could not account for Mr. Raddick's reports, which are in the record, which you put in the record and didn't object to, that's also a problem. But they're two independent. grounds, Your Honor, to answer your question. The second point that counsel for SRM today raised is regarding the motion for reconsideration. In that motion for reconsideration, Judge Lester, who's not the presiding judge, but who was on the panel, and the presiding judge was still on the panel for the motion for reconsideration, indicated that SRM's real argument here regarding the Rule 4 issue and the issue of Mr. Raddick's reports being in the record, their real argument here is simply that they have issue with the board's finding the government's expert to be more credible. It's really the point there is that the reconsideration decision and the initial decision both are in sync with respect to credibility, because the initial decision, the board, as I mentioned, said expressly that Mr. Hudak was credible. He was a credible witness. Did not say that of Mr. Fordham. In contrast, said that Mr. Hudak's analysis was more persuasive. The credible witness was more persuasive than Mr. Fordham. And then you go to the reconsideration decision. It's the same point, which is that they're making, which is that at the end of the day, your expert was not more credible than the testifying expert. That's exactly what the initial board found, is that Mr. Hudak was more credible and was more persuasive. It's two ways of saying the same thing. So I don't see any daylight between the reconsideration decision and the initial decision. The findings are the same, contrary to what SRM posited today. Unless there are further questions, we ask that you affirm the board's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Walters, you have several minutes here left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
A couple points I'd like to raise. First of all, on the last point on reconsideration, the board did not make a finding or a comparative finding as to the credibility of Mr. Hudak versus Mr. Fordham. And it's at Appendix 14, which is on page 4 of that order. The board says SRM's real complaint is that we did not find its expert witness credible, which is not the issue that we raised on the motion for reconsideration. The board took it upon itself to assess Mr. Fordham's credibility. The other issue with regards to Mr. Raddick, although we candidly and readily admit that his reports and records were in the record, or his reports and the cost, the supporting data, Mr. Raddick was never tendered as an expert in this case. He was never accepted by the court as an expert in this case. He was not subject to direct examination. He was not subject to cross-examination. And in effect, what the board did was they gave him more credibility in his absence than they gave to Mr. Fordham at present there to testify as to his methodology. And the final point I'd like to make is, Judge Dyke, you asked a question of government's counsel whether the board's finding as to Mr. Fordham's lack of distinguishing or resolving the conflicting methodologies was a central part of the decision. We contend it absolutely was a central part of the decision. The board specifically found we did not meet our burden of proof because of that, because Mr. Fordham had not adequately explained the prior experts' opinions. With that, I yield back the rest of my time. We would ask that the board reverse this and remand it to the board. The court reverse this and remand it to the board. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Walters. Thank you, Mr. Oliver. The case is submitted.